If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. You did not want to be convicted of treason in medieval England. The penalty was likely to be a particularly brutal, humiliating, and very public demise. That was because, as you're about to hear from Dr. Amanda Vitti, treason was seen as breaking the social bond between men that underpinned the way that upper echelons operated. And the matter of treason became particularly heated in the troubled times of the later 14th and early 15th centuries. Putting the questions to Dr. McVitie was our content director, David Musgrove.
So, today I am joined by Dr. Amanda McVitie, who is lecturer in history at Massey University in New Zealand. So that means for the purpose of this interview, I'm up at an unseemly hour in the morning and Amanda is working late for us. So if anyone spots an early morning mania in me and a relaxed evening ambience from Amanda, that's what's going on. Her new book, Treason and Masculinity in Medieval England, is published by Boydell and Brewer. So that is the topic that we're discussing today, treason and masculinity. Amanda, first question, are you able to define what treason was in the Middle Ages and who defined it?
So one of the fascinating and quite challenging things about studying treason in the medieval period is there was no single agreed meaning. So treason wasn't a matter of black and white legal definition. It existed on this continuum of shades of grey. And in medieval England, we're dealing with a society that's quite strongly shaped by the cultural forces of chivalry and ideals of knighthood, but also one that's more broadly based on social bonds and personal and family loyalties. So from the king downwards, you in this hierarchical political structure, medieval government functioned through ties of patronage, service, lordship, and affinity between men. So in this political and social context, we get long-standing customary ideas of treason as a betrayal of knightly honour and of personal loyalties between men, rubbing up against and sometimes also conflicting with more formal legal definitions. And complicating things further is that treason was often manipulated for political ends, with accusations of treason being used by powerful men to get rid of their political enemies. And this discourse of the wicked advisor that is very comes up again and again in the history of this period. So at its most basic, treason included what seem fairly obvious crimes, like trying to kill the king, fomenting rebellion, or waging war against the king in his own realm. But it also extended to more nebulous offences, like publicly questioning the king's legitimacy, seeking to disinherit him or his heirs, or trying to deprive him of his subjects' love. Now, having said all that, the first statutory definition of treason in English law came in 1352's Great Statute of Treasons. And this included clauses that define treason as trying to kill the king, the queen, or the king's eldest son, but also of having sexual intercourse with the king's wife, his eldest unmarried daughter, or the wife of his eldest son. So these offences that were seen as tainting the royal bloodline and, you know, interfering with that process of dynastic succession and political legitimacy. So here we see treason being imagined as a very intimate crime focused on the person of the king and on his immediate family as an extension essentially of his royal body. But the statute then goes on to more public types of treason, such as attacking the chancellor or other senior government officials while they were about the king's business, or forging the king's seal. And in the period I focus on, that legal scope gets steadily expanded, and we also start to see the idea of treason as acts against the people and nation of England or against the public good of the realm. And beyond these legal definitions, and sometimes in conflict with them, are also cultural ideas of treason as a betrayal of manly honour and of bonds of loyalty that are seen as natural, so these natural ties that help, you know, designed by God to help human society function. And these bonds are often secured by sworn oaths. So, for example, men were called traitors because they'd shown cowardice in battle or because they had betrayed their lord by committing adultery with his wife. And these were common themes in chivalric literature, such as, you know, the stories of King Arthur. But these kinds of accusations also surfaced in real life.
That's a very full answer to my brief question to start with. So that sort of helps to define the problem. So you talked there about this great statute of treasons in 1352. So in the middle of the 14th century, and that's in the reign of Edward the Third. And then your period of study is kind of a bit later than that. Generally, you're looking more at sort of the later 14th, early 15th century. You've defined treason there quite extensively. When did people first start talking about it, though? Because, you know, treason obviously happened before that period. When are the first sort of references to treason as a concept?
I think actually the idea of treason goes well back into the earlier medieval period. And certainly we even see ideas of it in classical antiquity and indeed some of these treason laws that you see on the continent in the medieval period derive from that classical Roman law. So I think that notion, that more fundamental notion of trust and betrayal is probably quite fundamental to political society. But, you know, the later medieval period, we do certainly get much more concerned with trying to nail down legal definitions of it that operate alongside these other broader kind of cultural concepts of treason.
I got it. I see. So it's the legal situation in the 14th century that's perhaps making it more pertinent. So your period, let's say the 1380s through to the 1420s, is that a time when treason and treachery is particularly coming to the fore as a concept, or is it that people are trying to legally clarify it?
Well, a lot of it is that treason really becomes an issue, and this is still even the case today, where we see discourses of treason around, you know, Brexit and the Trump presidency and so on. But it comes to the fore in times of political and constitutional crisis, really, where there's a lot of uncertainty and conflict about where political power lies, the extent of that power, the nature of legitimate government, and who can legitimately wield the coercive power of the state or of sovereign authority in whichever form it takes, and how that power can be wielded. So the period I looked at, the sort of 1380s through to the 1420s, is a period where you do get an awful lot of this political uncertainty and conflict going on, partly because, you know, initially we have a royal minority with Richard II coming to the throne when he's just 10 years old, and you know, there's these other powerful men behind the scenes, and there's a bit of jockeying for power and so on. And Richard's reign overall is pretty unsettled, has these periods of great sort of uncertainty, conflicts, where conflicts over treason come to the fore because there are these factional kind of contests about who can be close to the king and therefore who can kind of wield power in the realm. But then Richard is deposed finally in 1399. He proves to be such a bad king that they decide to get rid of him. And his throne is usurped by his cousin, Henry Bolingbroke, who becomes King Henry IV. And as soon as you have that complete rupture in the normal line of succession, you get these questions about, first of all, how that process can actually be managed, how they can separate Richard from his crown, which has been, you know, theoretically delegated to him by God himself. But then a lot of questions about Henry's legitimacy, and particularly when Henry's own reign starts to not perhaps live up to people's expectations, and, you know, taxes are heavy and the wars aren't going well and so on. So that really carries on through the reign of Henry IV and then into the reign of his son, where these questions of, is he actually the true king, the legitimate king, or is there a more legitimate heir to the throne, continue to keep surfacing periodically. And then I think you have this wider context to consider over the 14th century and into the 15th century of the Hundred Years' War with France. So this period of periodic conflict, campaigns in France, but also, you know, raids by the French on the English coastline and so on. Conflict among the king's advisors and the sort of senior nobles about the strategy for pursuing that war and whether or not they should be making peace or being more aggressive and so on. And outside that, you get a number of rebellions in this period, including the Great Revolt in 1381, and a major Welsh rebellion, which is led by Owain Glyndwr in the early 1400s, and that drags on for a number of years. And this sort of where you have the situation where you're quite often in conflict, you know, you're conducting military campaigns, that gets very expensive. So you also get these periodic financial crises too. And so all of those factors combined create this atmosphere of sort of increased conflict and the potential for accusations of treason to erupt as part of that political conflict.
Okay, so let's dive into this period in a bit more depth. So as you said, you've got Richard II, who's from 1377 to 1399. Then you've got Henry IV from then until 1413, and then Henry V after that. When you read your book, which is a really good read and very insightful for this topic, it feels like it's a roller coaster of accusations and counter accusations of treason between various factions and people. And there's lots and lots of stuff going on. So we're not going to be able to cover it all. But could you give us a very quick, rough summation of who is accused of treason and when during this period, so we get a good sense of what's going on?
So treason really arises in three broad contexts. The first are cases involving members of this political elite who were or were perceived to be too close to the king. And these are these accusations of context of treason that erupt in the context of factional politics, for want of a better term, as you get one group of men sort of trying to shift other groups that they see either as overt political enemies or as having monopolised the king's favour and therefore the patronage that then brings wealth and status and power and so on. So one really good example of this is the Merciless Parliament of 1388, very well named, in which basically a group of nobles who had been somewhat frozen out of Richard's inner circle and from some of those privileges of power and of being close to the king launched these accusations of treason against a group of men that were termed in very stereotypical terms as the king's wicked advisors. So they were seen as men who had basically weaseled themselves into the king's inner circle. And because Richard was then, at that time, he wasn't that young, but he was represented in the treason accusations as being very young and vulnerable and open to manipulation by these men around him. So that there was basically a purge, and a number of these men were, these trials were staged in Parliament, and quite a number of people were executed during the Parliament itself. And then we get a response to that in 1397 with the Revenge Parliament, when Richard is, ruling in his full, his full manhood as an adult king, and he basically goes through the process of charging the nobles that had purged his own household and purged his intimates from around him in 1388. So they are in turn charged and convicted of treason. So the men convicted included Richard, Earl of Arundel, who was drawn through London and beheaded, and Richard's own uncle, the Duke of Gloucester, who had actually been already imprisoned in Calais. And he was murdered there, probably on Richard's orders, smothered to death by a feather bed. And then in 1399, with Richard's deposition and the accession of Henry IV, the tables get turned again as Henry then stages these very public trials of or convictions of Richard's most loyal supporters. Although on that occasion, Henry, in the interests of bringing peace to the kingdom and reunifying the political community, didn't actually have any of them executed then, but a number of them went on to attempt a rising against Henry with the intention of restoring Richard to the throne. And during the course of that rising, they were basically killed by mobs. So they were accused of treason by these mobs of people in the various towns where they had fled to, and killed before they could be brought back before the king to be formally convicted and executed. So then you also get the second kind of context where these outbreaks of treason happen, is when you get formerly loyal noblemen and knights who, for various reasons, come to oppose the king and sometimes to mount rebellions against him. And we see quite a bit of this in the first decade of Lancastrian rule. So we get supporters like the powerful Percys of Northumberland, who originally backed Henry when he invaded England with his military forces and eventually deposed Richard. But then they later turned against him. Some historians say this was for personal gain, others because they held sincere political principles. So the Percys were themselves circulating a manifesto in which they said that Henry had actually murdered Richard and broken an oath not to seize the throne, and so that by rising against him, they were defending the public good of the realm. And Henry V actually also faced some similar kind of treason from people who had been noblemen who had been relatively close to him. And the third context in which we see treason arising in this period, which is at the other end of the social scale, really, so from these noble plots and factions and counterfactions and so on, we get cases that primarily arise from a new or an increased focus on political dissent under the new Lancastrian regime. And this is where we see a focus much more on the prosecution of treasonous speech. So people saying things like, you know, spreading public rumours that Richard was going to return and reclaim his throne because Henry was not the legitimate king. And these kinds of cases involved very ordinary people, so, you know, servants and artisans and so on. In one case, a man who's described simply as a vagrant who's been wandering from town to town, allegedly spreading the story that, you know, Henry was not the legitimate king at all and Richard was going to, you know, come back with an army any day and reclaim his throne, and so all his loyal followers should be ready to rise up and support him. So, you know, some of these cases really started simply with talk being overheard in taverns or the circulation of rumours, and in other cases with the circulation of written handbills and petitions. And sometimes those petitions actually get sent to foreign courts as well, asking for people like, the King of France to intervene on behalf of Richard II and help him reclaim his throne. And so these cases too, a number of them have a more direct connection to the context of this ongoing war with France and also the rebellion in Wales. So in one case, an accused man was charged for allegedly boasting that, you know, he was about to go off to France to join up with the French Dauphin and fight against the English. And in another case, a man was charged with treason because he was overheard saying that he was going to join the rebels in Wales, partly because the pay was supposedly so much better. So, and then from 1406, we also see royal authority starting to make a more direct causal connection between religious dissent and political dissent, so that treason and heresy become quite intertwined in the eyes of the royal justice system. And that really reaches a peak in 1414 with a new statute that causally links the Lollard heresy and treason and gives royal authorities a mandate to root out and destroy both religious and political dissenters who are seen as equal threats to the body politic of the realm.
Okay, thanks. So that's you've done very well there, summarising some of the big events. I'm sure most of our listeners are completely clear about this, but you used the word Lancastrian a couple of times there. Perhaps you could just clarify completely. So we've got Richard II. He's effectively deposed by Henry IV, and that's what we're talking about here. So just clarify that completely for us, could you?
Okay, so Henry the Fourth was Richard's cousin. So he was the son of John of Gaunt, and he was the hereditary Duke of Lancaster. So hence the fact that they are sometimes talked about as the Lancastrian kings or the Lancastrian bloodline that then comes down through the 15th century period. So it's where the royal bloodline sort of takes a bit of a dog leg away from Richard's direct line and jumps to his cousin Henry and his successors. And this, of course, becomes, you know, involved in this later, the conflict later in the 15th century between the Yorkists and the Lancastrians.
Brilliant. And obviously that's a very complicated business that we're not going to get into in this conversation. So what you've defined there is basically treason becoming quite a broad brush thing that's used for lots of different purposes, which leads me to wonder, did people actually believe the underlying concept of treason in this period? Or were they just using it as a legal mechanism to either achieve power, exact revenge, or just get their political aims done? It was just like a legal tool that enabled people to get stuff done.
I really think it operates as both. And it's obviously very difficult, if not impossible, to get into the heads of some of these people and determine what they really believed as opposed to what they said they believed in public. But there does seem to be, although treason is certainly used as a very useful political weapon, there is certainly this underlying quite deep and I think quite sincere cultural anxiety about who you can trust and the potential for these personal bonds between people to become corrupted. And certainly you see this in fears of these masculine bonds that hold the political community together that are already secured through vows and sworn oaths, that you see the idea coming up again and again that men might swear false bonds to each other and form these bonds of confederacy and conspiracies against the king. And that idea, that cultural fear, is quite sincere, despite the fact that on occasion treason is a very convenient political weapon to get rid of your personal enemies and your political enemies. So I think it operates basically on both levels, really.
We'll come back to the masculinity bit in a second if we can. But I suppose one of the problematic bits with treason in this period is a king is deposed. So that is essentially an act of treason, I suppose, against Richard II in Richard II's view. At what point do we get an idea, if at all, of the separation of king versus country and you being able to commit treason to one or the other or both?
Well, it doesn't really fully it's not fully defined to that extent in this period, but certainly that idea is coming through. But I think it helps you to get a sense of how medieval people understood the relationship between the king and the realm. And this to some degree ties back into my centering of gender, really, in this analysis. So in medieval political thought, the body politic was imagined as a male body with the king as its head and as male subjects as its working limbs. So the whole thing was envisaged as operating as a single organic whole, so that the king both embodied and represented the realm, or, to some degree, thinking about the concept of the nation emerging here as well. So an individual king had a natural mortal body that would eventually age and die, but kingship was an immortal, as an immortal body would continue. So the trauma of Richard's deposition had shown the difficulties of separating a living king from the body politic of the crown. And as a usurper, Henry IV had to prove his right to hold sovereign power, prove his legitimacy by convincingly joining his own mortal body to this enduring body politic. And one way he did do this was by using charges of treason to construct attacks on himself or defiance of his rule as an attack on the nation of England. And this starts to come out in charges that traitors were planning to destroy the language and laws of England. So these ideas that really symbolise an emerging sense of nationhood as having shared laws and a shared language. But that strategy could really cut both ways. So in a number of cases I examined, accused traitors defended themselves by saying they were being loyal to the crown or to the nation precisely because they were resisting Henry, who they were saying was an illegitimate usurper. So this idea of the king and the nation as entities that were entwined but not completely coterminous was definitely emerging over the course of the later medieval period. But it isn't really until later that we see what we could talk about as a complete abstraction of the nation state in the way that we think of it today, that's completely separate from the body of the king.
It's quite a trick that Henry has to pull off, isn't it, to explain his legitimise his rule and simultaneously explain that Richard II wasn't any good. Now you've talked about gender here a little bit, and it's very interesting, I think, reading your book to try and get to grips with this. So let's try and answer this. So treason and masculinity are kind of linked very closely in your assessment of what's going on here. And you talked about oath breaking and the importance of trust, and that goes back, you know, many centuries, doesn't it? I think of the Bayeux tapestry and oaths being made by Harold to William and things like that, and then being broken and perjury, and lots of things fall out of that. So what's just talk us through this a bit more? How important is this male bond friendship business in the concept of treason?
Well, I think it goes beyond friendship, really. It's the fact that we're talking about a personal monarchy where government really relies on these voluntary associations between men to function. So there's no, you know, there's no fully professionalized civil service or bureaucracy or anything that we have in a modern polity. So government functions through these personal and political bonds between men. And what comes through very strongly in the narratives of treason proceedings is this fundamental idea of the traitor as the opposite of the true man. So this is more the cultural context in which treason is defined, that influences the way treason is defined in law. So this ideal of true manhood seems to have been a fairly universal ideal in medieval England, and that it applied to men at all levels of society, not just to that sort of elite of the men close to the king and so on. So a true man was loyal and honourable. He upheld justice and he was obedient to right order. And his word was his bond. So these were really essential virtues in a society in which social, economic and political relationships were still forged primarily through verbal oaths rather than written contracts. So we have written contracts and indentures starting to be used more, but they're still fundamentally backed by a man's sworn oath. So what I really discovered through examining the records for these, these cases of treason, the actual narratives of prosecution and so on, was that regardless of how treason actually manifested in practice, whether that was staging a rebellion or trying to deprive the king of his subjects' love or in one rather colourful case, plotting to murder the king by smearing a necromancer's poisonous ointment on his saddle, every instance was really described as beginning with the breaking of these masculine bonds that were seen as natural because they were the bonds by which society was held together and through which it functioned, through which politics and government and so on functioned. So this is comes back to this idea that these personal and familial relationships, some of which were friendship, some of which were much, you know, not necessarily that intimate in terms of friendship and love, but certainly of affinity and patronage and loyalty, that they were quite, they were inherently fragile and open to corruption. So these fears about men forming bonds of, you know, conspiracy and bonds of confederacy and so on, that was a persistent fear throughout the period as well.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So it symbolised his undoing as a knight because he had completely lost his knightly honour through his act of treason. And then this process of the hanging and the drawing and the disemboweling. So each step in this process actually had its own political meaning that would have been understandable to the wider populace.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You mentioned chivalry in your first answer when we first started talking. Is chivalry a sort of a fully formed concept by this time in the 14th century? And how does that play into this argument?
Well, chivalry is one of those concepts that we often think we know what it means, but when we start to dig into it, we realise it's a much more slippery concept than. And it's much broader and more plastic than we imagine. But certainly when we look at treason proceedings, these ideals of chivalry do get, especially in the way men try to defend themselves, that the claims to being a true knight and to upholding chivalric virtues of honour and loyalty and so on come through quite strongly in the way men try to defend themselves. at that broader cultural context too, whereby the idea, the way treason is understood in chivalric contexts, through not just through the way it's portrayed in sort of chivalric literature like Arthurian romances and so on, but also in the context of the way it's defined through the court of chivalry that is, you know, handles accusations of chivalry that take place in military contexts and that have their origin outside the realm. So, for example, cases where someone is accused of handing over an English fortress to the French in France and so on. So that kind of aspect of chivalric culture is also influencing the way treason is understood and defined and expressed in legal contexts.
And this all helps to understand this concept of the wicked advisor, the person who's too close to the king, doesn't it? Because when I remember when I was studying medieval history at school, I was surprised at how interested people seemed to be by these favourites and advisors, and why. And I couldn't quite understand why it was such a big deal. But then when you think about it, and having read your work, it's very obvious that, you know, that those people are controlling access to power. And that's a key element here. So it's all quite Shakespearean in a way. So that's important, right? So this the wicked advisor concept is a big part of this story, yeah?
Yes, definitely. Although I think it's important to distinguish that because this is a personal monarchy and, you know, the king rules through this sort of cascading structure of personal relationships between men, and that is completely normal for him to be surrounded by men he's close to and trusts, and that these men will actually, by having the king's favour, will control patronage and the channels of power and so on. But the accusations about people being wicked advisors that are often, you know, incorporated into these treason proceedings, particularly those that involve quite high status men who are within the intimate circles of royal power, they often arise, they don't come out of a vacuum. So often there's other kind of more, we might call them practical tensions going on behind the scenes. So, for example, in the lead up to the merciless parliament and this big purge of the wicked advisors that goes on then, there is this background where there's a lot of conflict about how the war with France should be managed and what the strategy should be. So that kind of background of sort of military and political tensions that underlie specific military and political and sometimes economic tensions, sort of financial crisis and so on, that underlie these accusations of wicked advisors when they arise. But definitely the sense that access to patronage needs to be managed quite carefully to make sure people aren't being too frozen out and too excluded otherwise, especially with these very powerful men who consider themselves to have the natural right to counsel the king and to be part of that inner circle that's deciding matters of policy and military strategy and so on, when they are pushed to the outside by other men who are often described as being less worthy and of lower social status, so kind of social climbers in a sense, who've weaseled their way into the king's inner circle and are claiming positions above their natural station, that's when these accusations really tend to kick off.
So if treason as a concept is all about men and male bonds, could women be traitors?
Well, this is one of the really interesting things I discovered in the course of this research, is that there were certainly women involved in these treason proceedings. In a couple of cases, they appear as anonymous women who have been responsible for circulating these rumors and stories about, you know, Henry being illegitimate and basically being channels for this verbal political dissent and unrest, but they don't actually get charged with treason themselves. In those kinds of cases, what happens is the man that actually repeats those stories in public is the one that gets charged with treason and executed, and the woman basically just disappears from the record. And then in a number of other cases with more high-status women involved in treason plots, so, for example, Maud de Vere, who was the Countess of Oxford, and also Constance Lady Despenser, they actually seem to have masterminded treason plots themselves, although there were other, you know, they had their own servants and other men involved and sort of pulled into them. But when it comes to the processes of investigation and punishment, they fade into the background. And if they get punished at all, it's with much less severe and more private punishments than their male accomplices. So, for example, in Maud de Vere's case, she simply had her lands and revenues seized by the king for a few months, but she was never arrested or anything like that. And then she was sort of given everything back again. So there was no long-term consequences for her. Now, this was because in a masculine political culture in which women were basically excluded from government office and other formal channels of power, they were thought to lack political agency by definition and therefore to be incapable of the political crime of treason, although they could be convicted of the crime of petty treason, which was to kill your husband, or petty treason also covered, say, a servant killing his master and so on. So the inversion of the natural order, basically. But not this treason in the political sense, in which the sense that the other men in the treason cases I look at in this book are conceived. So while on the one hand these gendered structures of power denied women the privileges of political subjecthood, on the other hand their very invisibility in a political sense might, I think, have paradoxically left them freer to operate sort of behind the scenes and under the radar of those royal authorities. So it is a very interesting dimension of treason, I think, that this that women just don't, certainly not until really into the 16th century, we see women being accused of high treason or of political treason.
Now, if you did find yourself on the wrong end of an accusation of treason in the 14th century, you're in a bit of a sticky situation, aren't you? Because chances are those in power want to exact some revenge on you. So you could use a thing, and correct me if I've misunderstood, you could use a sort of defence of the Latin term is diffidatio, which is basically saying that you think that the king is ruling badly and it's your right or indeed your duty to do something about it. Or there was also the option of a trial by combat, which you talk about quite a lot in your book. So just drop us into what you could do if you are accused of treason.
So diffidatio and trial by combat are both really good examples of how customary and chivalric understandings of treason coexisted with and indeed could sometimes contest more formal legal and statutory definitions. So diffidatio was the formal renunciation of liege homage, that is, when a man formally renounced his sworn oath of fidelity and service to his lord, because that lord was failing to honour his own reciprocal obligations. And this idea of diffidatio extended to a customary belief that as the men chosen by God to help kings enforce royal justice, knights and noblemen had the right, even the duty, to curb a king who was ruling unjustly or who had turned tyrant. So ideally, kings who were going off the rails would be corrected by the wise counsel of these elite men and by removing bad influences from the inner circles of royal power. But if this didn't work, the right to diffidatio could in theory take the form of armed resistance. And in practice, this noble right to diffidatio had been all but extinguished during Edward I's time. He cracked down pretty harshly on nobles who did try to exercise it. However, in a number of the cases I looked at, elite men were clearly still drawing on this customary idea of diffidatio to defend themselves from accusations of treason. For example, when in 1397, the Duke of Gloucester was charged with treason for having been part of the purge of Richard's court in 1388's merciless parliament, he tried to defend himself by saying he'd only done these things to remove bad advisors from around the king and to restore good government to the realm. So trial by combat was also an ancient custom, in this case reaching right back to the early Middle Ages and trial by ordeal. Now, by the 14th century, trial by combat was largely seen as a knightly privilege adjudicated by the court of chivalry. It was used in cases where one man accused another of treason, but there was no independent evidence for whether that accusation was true or false. So the idea was that God would reveal which man was telling the truth through his victory in the combat. The loser, if he survived, would then be immediately executed as a proven traitor. So in a sense, a trial by combat was men's words made flesh, as the truth of what they were saying was tested upon their bodies. And this was quite a ritualized process that started with the traditional throwing of gauntlets. But the centrality of men's words was really symbolized when the accuser's written charges and his opponent's written response to those charges were inserted into their respective gauntlets. And the gauntlets were then twisted together as the resort to trial by combat was declared.
It's a pretty risky strategy, though, the trial by combat.
It's not very common at all, really. I mean, there are a number of cases in this study that I did look at, but it's probably not going to be your first option. And it wasn't, it wasn't something that was accessible to, you know, a lot of people. It was very much, in the sense that I'm looking at it with the court of chivalry and so on, it was very much part of this elite, you know, sort of elite world.
Right. So coming towards the end, if you did get yourself convicted of treason, if your defence failed, then you were probably in line for a pretty brutal, public, humiliating end. You talked about that one chap being dragged through the streets on the back of a hurdle, for instance. What sort of demises did people meet, and why were these endings quite so brutal?
Well, the process of the ritual around an execution, first of all, it was public to really communicate the message to the entire political community of the nature of this person's complete undoing as a political subject. So the process of drawing, which was being dragged through the streets generally on a hurdle behind a horse. So the idea was really to completely undo the traitor's identity as a political subject and to permanently exclude him from the body politic of the realm through this quite symbolic ritual of degradation and punishment. And if we look at high status traitors, men like Henry Le Scroope, who was executed during the reign of Henry V, before he was actually dragged through the streets and beheaded, he went through a ritual which was essentially the reverse of the knighting ritual. So his sword belt was stripped from him and his spurs were cut off, you know, were sort of cut off. So it symbolized his undoing as a knight because he had completely lost his knightly honor through his act of treason. And then this process of the hanging and the drawing and the disemboweling. So each step in this process actually had its own political meaning that would have been understandable to the wider populace. So you have, you know, a populace that isn't necessarily literate, but this is a form, the traitor's body serves as a form of political communication, as a kind of text, really. So, for example, disemboweling was because people's evil thoughts were thought to arise from their bowel. So this kind of reflected medieval medical theory about where evil thoughts came from. And, you know, the beheading was the traitor had tried to strike the head from the body politic by killing the king or attacking the king. So his own head was struck off and then his body was divided. And often the body parts were sent to significant locations and posted in very public places where that message could be communicated to everyone. So in Henry LeScroope's case, he came from, his family was very strongly associated with the city of York. So his head, after he was executed, his head was sent to York and posted on the city walls where everyone would see it. And this destruction and dismembering of the body was really a form of complete stripping away of the person's identity and social status and any kind of sense that they had a place as a political subject in the realm, in that body politic.
So, summing up, the picture you're painting there is one of like a really unstable, brutal sort of society, very dangerous for people, certainly in the higher echelons of power, to maintain their place and not end up with in a horrible position like you've just described. I suppose, having looked at done all this research, having thought about it, what are the main themes that you bring out from looking at this topic? What how does it help us to understand the medieval period more generally from what you've looked at?
Well, I think we need to remember that treason is at heart really a constitutional issue. So it's about defining the limits of political power in the realm and where power lies and who can wield it, what makes legitimate political power versus illegitimate power, authority versus power. And by going through this process of defining the traitor's offences and describing the entities against which they have offended, you're actually kind of also defining the wider constitutional structures of the realm. So the relationship between the king and the realm and the king and his subjects and the realm and this emerging idea of the community of the realm and the nation of England and so on. So I think treason is quite an interesting way to get an insight into these broader political questions and concerns, really. And it also, helps us understand more about how kingship was embodied and also the relationships and roles of other political entities that go into making up that the government and the body politic and notions of legitimate authority and sovereignty and the limits of political authority, really. I sort of see this study as contributing to the wider scholarship, both on queenship, so gender and queenship, and also some recently some quite excellent studies on kingship and masculinity that really demonstrate we can't fully understand medieval political thought and sort of legal and constitutional history without attention to gender. And I think this is the way sort of more scholarship is starting to go now, where we are starting to recognize that we really need to understand, you know, how these ideas about manhood and kingship intersected and so on, in order to understand how political power was imagined and the limits of political possibility, and to understand why particular political conflicts sort of spun out in the ways that they did, and the particular types of discourses and accusations and so on that were more or less effective in sort of waging both political debate and sort of more full-on political conflicts. So I think it really has some wider implications for the history of kingship, and also understanding different models of political subjecthood as well, and people coming to see themselves as loyal to the king, but also as having these wider loyalties to ideas of the people and the nation of England and so on.
That was Dr. Amanda McVitie. Her new book, Treason and Masculinity in Medieval England, is published now by Boydell and Brewer. If you're interested in medieval history, then make sure you sign up for our medieval newsletter at historyextra.com/newsletters. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman.